Ladies and gentlemen, isn't it nice to be called that and have it fit? It's good to be here because good is here. And I wish to thank whoever was responsible for asking me to come. To me, it's very unusual for me to be asked back any place. I can remember days when I was never asked back. But it's been a number of years since I was here, and I was really surprised when they called and asked me to come back, which I was glad to do. They didn't have to give me such a warm welcome. There's a song that starts out, "It took a miracle to put the world in space. It took a miracle to hang the stars in place. But when he saved my soul, cleansed and made me whole, it took a miracle of love and grace." You are looking at a miracle. This room contains many miracles. But the thing that I have to constantly remember is that I have been the receiver of a miracle and not the creator of one. I'm Dr. Paul F. I'm a problem drinker. If I had been born earlier, they would have called me the village drunkard. But the word drunkard, you see, is so socially unacceptable that they coined another word for us and they called us alcoholics. And now the word alcoholic is just as unacceptable in society, and so now they call us problem drinkers. Pretty soon we'll all become known as victims of Jelinek's disease. And that won't tell anybody anything. I'm sober today because when I got up this morning, I decided that today I would not drink. And by the grace of God and the principles of AA, I have been able to carry out that decision, at least until right now. I am alive today, however, because the good Lord in His infinite mercy put some people on the face of this earth who were willing to go to any lengths to keep me from killing myself. Incidentally, I came 600 miles to talk, and you people kind of moseyed over here to listen. If you get through before I do, don't be afraid to leave. If I say something that festers your serenity, please feel free to get up and leave. There's nothing that says that you have to sit there and be agitated by me. Like my friend from North Carolina says, if I see an animal coming at me and it looks like a duck, and it waddles like a duck, and it quacks like a duck, it's a cotton-picking duck. And so I guess I must be a duck. A man walked up to his minister one Sunday and said, "Preacher, I've got a problem." He said, "I come to church on Sunday morning, and I listen to the music, and it makes me feel good. I listen to the words out of your big book, and it makes me feel better. And I listen to your sermon, and it makes me feel even better. And when I leave the church, I feel like I could lick the world. And then comes Monday." And the minister said, "Yes, I know exactly what you mean." He said, "I have people who stand up in front of me and vow before God to love and to obey in sickness and in health until death do them part, and then comes Monday." You see, in AA, we don't have any Mondays. We don't have any Saturdays or Sundays. We got 24-hour periods with no names. But if I can just help you with Monday, my trip will have been worthwhile. You see, we're very accident-prone people. We get up every morning and we run right into living. And we have to do something about this. I went to my first AA meeting. No, I shouldn't say that. I was dragged to my first AA meeting. I was three-quarters drunk. I was a full-blown agnostic. I was $54,000 in debt and didn't know it. I had lost the right to manage money. raise my kids as I see fit, run my house as I see fit. As far as I knew, I had lost every right that I had, except the right to vote. They hadn't taken my right to vote away. I had about as much awareness of what my problem was as the Irish truck driver who took his big semi and ran it underneath a bridge that was just a tad too low. And he got this dude stuck in there, and nothing he could do would get it unstuck. And just about that time, this Irish cop came up on a motorcycle and drove up next to the cab and said to the man, he says, "Are you stuck?" And the driver says, "No, I'm not stuck." He says, "I'm delivering this bridge, and I've lost the address." Or the fellow that says, "I only drink to calm my nerves, my steadiness to improve. Last night I got so steady that I couldn't even move." As I stand here tonight, I am no longer a drinking alcoholic. I am no longer an agnostic. I'm no longer $54,000 in debt. I regained the rights that I lost, and I do understand what my problem is. So obviously, someplace between that first meeting and today, a lot of things have happened to me. And I thought maybe if I could just get you from that first meeting to where I'm standing, just maybe it will help one individual in this room besides myself. It's going to help me, and maybe I can help one other. In order for me to get where I'm standing, a certain set of ingredients had to be put together. Much like you ladies would build a cake from scratch instead of out of a box, you see. I had to have a certain set of ingredients put together. No different than any other alcoholic. The first thing that had to happen to me would be the creation from within or from without, what George Wiedemann would call a sincere and monumental desire to get well. Now, anything less than this magnitude, you see, will doom me to failure, because unless getting well comes first above everything else, I will rationalize my way out. If I allow anything to come between me and staying sober, I'll get drunk. It's predictable. So getting sober, staying sober, and not drinking has to come first before anything. The alcoholic who is still drinking is no better than some discarded can or bottle, totally worthless to himself and totally worthless to society. But you know, you can take this can or bottle, and with the application of some external force, you can remold this can or bottle into something better than you started with. But the alcoholic who stands up and says, "I can do it myself," is the same person who is going to stand there and tell me that a can or bottle can recycle itself, and I won't believe it for 1 minute. Another thing that bothers me is that we settle for good enough when we could have the very best there is by the exertion of a little more effort. But we're willing to settle for good enough. If you could visualize for a minute a garage sitting in a lot, and it hasn't been used for a while, and the weeds have grown up, and the driveway is practically hidden from view, and the paint's peeling off the wood, and it has become a neighborhood eyesore, and the people don't like this, and so they get after the landlord to do something about this garage. And he comes out, and with a crowbar and a hammer, he knocks the garage down one board at a time till it's flat with the cement. But being Scotch, he doesn't like to waste his lumber, so he takes and nails it all back up again in another shape. And he gets back across the street, and lo and behold, he's built the biggest outhouse in the neighborhood. And the people don't like that either. So he tears it all down again, same board, same nails, same tools. And then he puts it all back together again. And this time he has built himself a small chapel. Now, a garage can be converted into a chapel. But the garage is totally incapable of converting itself into a chapel. When you deal with an alcoholic, you run a risk that you may wind up with somebody worse than you started with, like the outhouse. But it's worth the risk when you consider that out of 36 alcoholics, 35 are going to die. It's worth the risk. And we settle for good enough, you see, when we could have the very best there is. Merely desiring to stay sober wasn't going to get the job done for me either. Lord knows we wanted to get sober before we ever came to this program, as you well know, and everything we try fails. Just desiring to stay sober won't get the job done. I had to learn to accept some things. I went to that first meeting. They dragged me down in that bank building. And back in those days, there wasn't any air conditioning down in there, and my God, I like to die. You know, people that drink a lot for some stupid reason like to smoke a lot. And these people were down in the basement of this bank building, and they dragged me down there three quarters drunk. And I hadn't smoked for 5 years when I came to AA. And I was honestly convinced that they were trying to asphyxiate me. Talking about smoking while I'm on the subject. I hadn't smoked for 5 years when I came to AA. When I finally decided to get off of alcohol, I knew that when I gave up the alcohol, I was going to shake. And for some reason, you can't have a doctor shaking like this, you see. The patients don't like that for some reason. They object to that. So with typical alcoholic thinking, I said, when I used to smoke, I didn't shake like that. So while I'm coming off the alcohol, if I could smoke a cigarette now and then, maybe I could get by long enough to get off of this booze. In 2 days, I was at three packs a day, and I smoked for another 9 years. And just last week, I had my eighth non-smoking birthday. But if today, I would be stupid enough... We're going to get them yet. If today I would be stupid enough to say, when I used to drink, I didn't do this. So if I could take a drink now and then, maybe I could get by. And by Friday, I'd be at a fifth a day and I'd be dead by Sunday, you see. Well, I sat in that room and I couldn't see the front. I had no idea to this day who the speaker was. Out of this smoke-filled haze, he says to me, "You're an alcoholic." And I says, "So what?" To an Irish drinker, that's like graduating cum laude, you see. It didn't mean anything. Someplace else in his talk, he says, "You can never, ever drink again." And I says, "You just dropped dead." I didn't go to AA to stop drinking. I went to AA to get those shoes out of the middle of my back. I wanted to go back and drink like normal folks, quotation marks, question mark. Someplace else in his talk, he said, if you want to get well, my God, I didn't know I was sick. He said, if you want to get well, there are certain steps you can follow guaranteed to work. And I said to him, I said, well, that a man had dragged me down there. I said, what are these steps he's talking about? I looked where I came down. I could do those on my hands and knees, you see. So he picked up the 12 steps like the man read here a little bit ago, and all I could hear was God this, higher power that, make amends for this, and I knew I was hooked up with some kooky religious outfit that I didn't want any part of. And yet here I am. Well, certain things happened, you see. Number one, they threw a batch of statistics at me to start with. At that time, they said there were something like... maybe 200 million people in this country, 100 million of them drank alcohol at that time. And out of this 100 million, maybe there were 9.5 million who were full-blown alcoholics. And like any other alcoholic, I said, why me? Why did I have to be one of the 9.5 million instead of one of the 90.5 million who supposedly can still go out there and drink? Poor little old me. Well, I'll get back to why me in just a little bit. But this man had piqued my curiosity. You see, here he was telling this doctor that I had a disease. I didn't even know what he was talking about. So I got out my medical books, and I took all the free AA literature I could get. I wouldn't buy any. Whatever was for free, I took it. and I read about alcohol. You amass a mountain of facts about alcohol, most of which to this day aren't connected. In fact, when I came to this program, I didn't even wear glasses. Now I got trifocals. They ought to have a sign up there that says AA can be detrimental to your eyesight. Or if you don't wear glasses, you haven't read enough. But anyway, out of this mountain of facts, you see, certain things glared out at me. Now, psychiatrists would have me believe that I was an alcoholic, either because I was breastfed or bottle-fed, whichever one he wasn't, that I have suicidal tendencies, hate my mother or father, I must be a schizophrenic, or I come from a low economic group or a high economic group, or I must come from the left side of the tracks or the right side of the tracks. I must either be an only child or the middle one of 12 or the last one of 23. And I'm reading all these things, you know, and I'm visualizing at that time patients that I had that fit these categories, you know. I had three patients that attempted suicide and made it. I had patients that fit every one of these categories, none of whom were alcoholics that I know of. But at that time, all my patients were pregnant. And you know, they weren't pregnant for any of those reasons. The very simple fact is that I happen to be an alcoholic because I'm a genetic chemical cripple. And there isn't an engineer or a biochemist or what have you in the world that can go back in this carcass of mine and straighten out whatever's the matter with it. I'm stuck with it. There isn't anybody in this room that ever had to get thrown on the floor and had his mouth pried open and had the booze poured down his throat against his will. And neither did I, you see. I chose to drink it. Now, if I am an alcoholic because I drink alcohol and do something crazy with it, and if I drink the alcohol by my own choice, then I can't lay the blame for what happens on another living soul except myself. And until I'm willing to accept this responsibility, you see, I get absolutely no place with this program. Absolutely no place. He says, you can never ever drink again. I said, by God, I'll show you if I can. Typical Irish drunk, you see. And so I set out to prove that he was wrong, and you name it, and I tried it. I tried the combination, I tried days, I changed combinations, I changed it, you name it, I tried it. They all failed, and all they did was increase my intensity to the statement that I couldn't drink, you see. Every time it failed, I kept proving that he was right, and it made me madder by the minute. I also had to accept the fact that since alcohol was my problem, I had a couple of choices. I could either be a drinking alcoholic, a non-drinking alcoholic, or a dead alcoholic. In fact, if the undertaker uses alcohol instead of formalin, I'm going to sit up. And then you're going to have a new member in about 2 days. I became victimized at the beginning with what I like to call analysis paralysis. I was so busy analyzing how, where, what could I have changed, what did I do wrong, where could I have, how, when, where, what, to the point where I was analytically paralyzed and didn't do anything. Now, the worst thing I could have done, probably, would be to switch to pills. That's a good trick. That's like putting pennies in your fuse box. It'll conduct a current, all right, but it'll burn down a house. Alcoholism is no bed of roses, you see. Merely accepting the fact that I was an alcoholic wasn't going to get the job done for me either. I needed something else called hope. You see, we become some of the most hopeless individuals that I know. People keep reminding us that we are hopeless. If you don't think so, just wait a minute and somebody will remind you each day that you are hopeless. They dragged me down that flight of stairs and they said, this will work. Now, why should I have any hope that this program would work any better than anything else? Well, I walked down that flight of stairs into a room full of people just like yourselves, all of whom were sober except me. Here I was, three-quarters drunk in a room full of people who said they used to be as bad as I was, only they didn't drink anymore. Now, either they were bold-faced lying to me, or else they had found something and tried it and it worked that I didn't know about yet. And I never yet saw an alcoholic who wasn't a pig. We're pigs about everything. You know, we'll take double hookers in each hand, we'll go early and stay late, we'll take fifths instead of pints, and on it goes. When we give up alcohol, we just change our piggishness to something else. We don't get rid of the piggishness. My problem's shifted over to ice cream. Now I eat ice cream by the half gallon, you see. No way would I consider one scoop of ice cream for anything. If you can't give me a half gallon, don't bring it in my house. One day I got in the freezer. My wife had gotten some popsicles for my grandchildren. Lord only knows when I had popsicles last, so I had six. We become pigs, you see, about everything. When we sober up, we become workaholics. If we switch to pills, we become pillaholics, you see. Our piggishness just gets switched into something either good or bad, hopefully something good. But these people had something, you see. What they did to begin with was to shoot down my Lone Rangerism. You see, when I came down that flight of stairs, I honestly didn't know another doctor who was hooked on booze. I knew some who were hooked on pills, but I didn't know one who was hooked on booze. I knew one who said he used to be, but alcoholics lie a lot, and I couldn't trust him, you see. Then a series of coincidences began to happen to me. Parentheses, you see. We call these things coincidences before we come to this program. Like when you take and stack your automobile against the telephone post and you shove your head right through the windshield. And you miss the solid metal roof to keep from decapitating yourself by about an inch. You stand out there on the sidewalk with the policeman with the blood running down your face, and you look at that stupid alcoholic automobile and you say, my God, wasn't that a coincidence? Coincidence. You go sailing out of the fourth floor of a Kansas City hotel and you get your foot caught in a drapery cord and you dangle there four flights above the street. And they haul you back in and you look out there at all that traffic down there and you say, my God, wasn't that a coincidence? It's a coincidence, we think, that we arrive at this program alive, you see. But like our nice young lady said, and my friend from Chicago said many moons ago, a coincidence is nothing more than a miracle in which God has chosen to remain anonymous. And I have been the receiver of a number of miracles, some of which I'll get to in just a little bit. But a series of coincidences began to happen to me. I don't know how else to explain how these people were able to take this drinking agnostic alcoholic to a Christmas Eve service, but they did it. And during this service, on some given signal, every light in that church went out. It got pitch black in that church, except for one candle that was up on the altar. And the minister lit a candle off of that one, and then he lit the candles that each of eight ushers had, and they went up and down the aisles lighting the candles of the people in the pews, and that church lit up like Monument Circle at high noon, all from this one little light. Now, I didn't get out of that what I was supposed to get out of it, you see. But what it was showing me was that I couldn't come to this program with a past that's black enough to put this program out. This program will work for anybody. If it doesn't work because the patient doesn't want it to work. But nobody has a past that's black enough that the program won't work if he wants it to. The very next meeting I went to, the man got up and said, if you have trouble with God stuff, which I did, spell it with two O's and be it. Now, there isn't anybody that can't be G-double-O-D if he wants to be. You can be good, good, good to the point where you're almost godly. In fact, in the other big book, it says good and God are synonymous. But what he was showing me was that I could take and substitute a word in these 12 steps so that I could hang on to one long enough to get to the next step, substitute if I had to get to the next step, and so on. Now, I've been criticized by people in AA before for telling you that you can substitute words in the 12 steps as if they were chiseled out of some kind of holy grail. But that doesn't bother me, because I know full well if you make this program, they'll be right back the way they were originally written anyway. But what irks me is that I'm criticized by the same group of people that don't think a thing about substituting the word slip for failure. And that bugs me. Then by coincidence, I picked up a little book, added another level to my trifocals. It happened to be the story of a farmer who had more problems than Job did. I swear he did. No matter what this poor soul tried to do, it didn't work. He planted corn and the rain came down, washed it out. His horse stepped in a hole and broke his leg. They shot the horse. His barn burned down. His pigs got cholera. You name it, and it happened to this poor soul. And one day he was standing along the fence and his neighbor walked up and said, "How in the world, in the face of all this disaster," he says, "do you have guts enough to get up in the morning and try to do anything?" And he says, "Well," he said, "I'm a student of the Bible." He said, "I've read the Bible many, many times. And in that book it says 150 times that it came to pass. No place in that book did it say it came to stay." So no matter where I find myself at the moment, you see, I don't have to put up with it very long because it's going to pass. I remember as a kid, we took a wagon someplace to get some free groceries because something was going on that the adults called the depression. You know, a depression disappeared. I remember a hellhole over in New Guinea during World War II and a whole world war disappeared. And we got rid of a Korean War and a Vietnamese War disappeared. There were a lot of good people who were alive in my lifetime, and they're gone. Even good passes. So that no matter where I find myself at the moment, I don't have to put up with it very long, and it isn't reason enough for me to drink. Then a man got up at a meeting like this, and he pointed his finger at me. You know how they'll do that, you know, just, Lord, if I was in a Rose Bowl, he'd have pointed right at me. And he says, "Do you know that you've got the God-given right not to drink if you don't want to?" Now, how about that? I went to that meeting, I didn't have any rights left, and this man stood up there and said I had the God-given right not to drink if I didn't want to. I did have some rights left. How about that? So much for hope. Hope by itself wouldn't get the job done for me. I needed something called faith. Now, you mention faith to an agnostic like I was, and all you're going to see are two shoes going through the nearest doorway. Because when you mention the word faith, somebody hangs a religious meaning on it. So, in order not to scare anybody, we'll substitute a word for faith and call it confidence. It means exactly the same thing, but it doesn't scare anybody. I had to develop confidence, you see, in myself. I had to develop confidence in other people. I had to develop confidence in some kind of a program. And I had to develop confidence in something bigger than the whole bit. But I had to learn to do this one thing at a time. Like it says, one seed at a time and a garden grows. A drop at a time and a river flows. A word at a time and a book is read. A stroke at a time and the paint is spread. A chip at a time and a statue's unveiled. A step at a time and a mountain gets scaled. One thing at a time and that done well is the only sure way to exceed and excel. You can paint, you can sculpt, you can climb, you can do it only one step at a time. I had to learn to do things one step at a time. Remember, I'm a pig. I had to develop confidence for me, you see. Remind me of the little art class that was going on in school, and the teacher told the kids to draw anything they wanted to draw. And he kept walking up and down the aisles, you know, like a teacher will do. They'll bug you to death. They drive you crazy looking over your shoulder, you know. And he came up to this little girl and he says, "What are you drawing?" And she says, "I'm drawing a picture of God." And he says, "How can you draw a picture of God? Nobody knows what he looks like." And she said, "They will when I get through." Confidence, you see. Little things, little man. Then they told me, take an inventory. My God, if you want to shoot down somebody's faith, tell them to take an inventory. What a thing to do to an individual. You use up a whole tank car of red paint on one page and two little black dots on the other page. And that's okay. Because those two little dots are the most important things in the world. Because any human being, drunk, sober, or otherwise, as long as he's still living, is not a zero. Even if he's only got these two little dots. And that's all it takes to put a brick on top of it and start a foundation, you see. One brick at a time. But remember, we're pigs. We don't like to start with a foundation. We want to start building on a ninth floor. And we get in trouble. Take an inventory. The two priests were walking down the street, and one priest said to the other, "Since I announced last Sunday that there was over 700 sins, I've had 92 requests for the list." Maybe you don't think those alcoholics ain't taking an inventory, huh? Then by coincidence, I read a thing in the paper that said, "I may not be somebody, but I am me. I cannot do everything, but some things I can do. The things I can do, I ought to do. And the things I ought to do, by the grace of God, I will do." So if I needed a place to start back, you see, I start back with what I ought to do. And the first thing that I have to do is to become 100% honest. It is utterly impossible to practice the disease of alcoholism without lying. By the same token, it is utterly impossible to gain any degree of serenity or sobriety without honesty. Reminds me of the fellow that drank too much liquor and he just slithered right off the chair and wound up under a table in this bar room. And his buddy that was with him decided to play a trick on him, so he taped a piece of Limburger cheese to his upper lip. She's had it happen to her. Even stone drunk, it didn't take him long to come out from under the table. And his eyes were big and buggy, and he was yelling, and he ran out in the street, and they could hear him running into the trash cans and making all kinds of commotion, and he came back in, and his face was livid red, and the perspiration is pouring down his face. And he stood in the middle of the bar room and said, "My God," he said, "the whole world stinks." But you see, it wasn't the whole world at all. It was right there. And until this alcoholic is willing to put it right there, you see, I get absolutely no place with this program. Guy says, "You can always tell when an alcoholic is lying." He says, "Yeah, how do you do that?" He said, "His lips are moving." Sometimes when you're feeling important, sometimes when your ego's in bloom, sometimes if you take it for granted that you're the best qualified in the room, sometimes if you think that your going would leave an unfillable hole, just follow this little example and see what it does for your soul. Take a bucket and fill it with water and stick your arm in it clear up to the wrist and then pull it out, and the hole that's remaining is a measure of how you'll be missed. You see, there's no such thing as an indispensable individual. Did you ever stop to think that even the word boss spelled backwards is double S-O-B? By the same token, there's no such thing as a perfect individual. Might as I try, you see, I know I will never be perfect. But I have the God-given right to try to be perfect, knowing full well that I'll never make it. Reminds me of the fellow that came home one day, says to his little boy, he says, "Have you been a good little boy?" And this kid says, "No." And he says, "Well, have you been a bad little boy?" And the kid said, "No." And he says, "Well, what have you been?" And this little kid, wise beyond his years, said, "Comfortable." You see, I'm going to win a few. I'm going to lose a few. If today I win just one more than I lose, I've had a good day. Like I told a fellow this afternoon, hell, I wasn't in the obituaries. I won today. If tomorrow I win one more than I did today, tomorrow's better than today. I'm not going to win them all. I'm a pig. I want to win them all, but I'm not going to. And since I'm perfect, not perfect, you see, I make mistakes. But mistakes are not reason enough for me to drink. The guy that goes on a slip, you know, mistake, slip, That's like a guy jumping off the 10-story building, and as he goes by the 6th floor, he said, "So far, so good." Boy, is he in for a rude awakening in a few minutes. I had to learn to become big enough to admit I was wrong when I was wrong. I had to become big enough to be able to say, "I'm sorry." Boy, try that on your egomania. I had to become big enough to be willing to start all over again from scratch. I had to become big enough that we is more important than I am. And I had to become big enough that as I think, that's exactly what I do. Then the other half of the statistics hit me. They said out of these 9.5 million alcoholics at that time, maybe there was 550,000 staying sober in AA, maybe. Maybe there was another 150,000 staying sober through some other method, roughly 750,000. Which means that there was 8.25 million people who were going to die from their disease because they didn't do anything about it, you see. And once again, I was forced to ask, why me? Why was I allowed to survive my disease instead of being one out of the 35 that's going to die? Remember, I'm a can in a bottle and I didn't recycle myself. Why was I allowed to do this, you see? And it reminded me, I saw a little thing in the paper that said, "I am the place where God shines through. He and I are one, not two. He needs me where and as I am, I need not fret nor stew nor plan. But if I stay relaxed and free, he'll carry out his plan through me." I was allowed to survive, you see, to become an agent. And to this day, I don't know an agent for what. I don't even know why I'm here. I can't explain why a man that I never met in my life would call me from 600 miles away and ask me to come and talk at this convention. I have no explanation for that, other than I'm supposed to be here not for my own good, but for something that he wants me to do. I have no other explanation for that. I'd have no idea who it is out in this audience that I'm supposed to be talking to, but he does, and so I'll just keep talking. I can't do it by myself. I need something called help. I say, "Why don't you use your willpower?" All right? If you think willpower has anything to do with this, to which I like to add nowadays, let's see, we're in Macon, Georgia, okay? If you think willpower has anything to do with this, you just drink a pint of castor oil, and you get in your automobile and drive nonstop to Miami. And see how much good your willpower is going to do. I needed help. Like the can or bottle, you see, I needed help. You know what you do with a sponge? You throw it in and it begins to absorb things. We come to this program and we have desecrated this physical being of ours, and we are entitled or obligated to put this body back in as good a shape as we can. Whatever kind of doctor it takes, we're entitled to it. We are entitled, we come to this program and we've got our thinking so screwed up that a cat couldn't do that to a ball of yarn, you see. And we're entitled and obligated to get our thinking straightened out. Whatever it takes. Psychiatrists, psychologists, whatever it takes, we're entitled to it. We come to this program with what I like to call gangrene of the soul. And I don't know medically if people would survive with gangrene unless you amputate it, you see. We become some of the most amoralistic individuals that I know. And we are obligated to do something about our immorality. Ministers, priests, rabbis, whatever it takes, we're entitled to it. We are also entitled to everything that AA has to offer. All I have to do is walk through that door and say, I desire to stay sober. Not even that I'm going to. I just desire to. And I'm entitled to everything that AA has to offer. Now, AA is not a mind reader. If I don't tell them what my problems are, they can't answer it, you see. AA is just like the Good Samaritan, you see. We give away and we keep getting, and we give it away and we keep getting, and we give it away and we keep getting. Then by coincidence, I picked up another book. And in this book, it was Vincent Peale's Power of Positive Thinking. And in this book, there were innumerable examples by people who said they had all kinds of problems, and that they solved their problems, not just alcohol, all kinds of problems. And they solved these problems through something called prayer. Now, Vincent Peale said that there was a power loose in this universe capable of solving anything. And that all I had to do to latch onto this power was to pray. Well, I look around, I don't see no power loose in the universe. I remember as a kid, you know, they told me if I took a plug and stuck it in the wall and then turn on the light would come on. And I did, and switched the switch, and it did. So like any other kid, I took a screwdriver and unscrewed the socket and wound up 6 feet from the wall. But I didn't see anything. There isn't anybody in this room that can tell me what gravity is. You can tell me what it does, but you can't tell me what it is. But if you don't believe it exists, just go out of that Kansas City hotel room and try to go up. You see. He said all I had to do to latch onto this power was to pray. I said, all right, they were right about some other things. Don't knock it till you try it. So I said, okay, I'll pray like they do. If there is a Lord, you do this for me and I'll do that for you. You get me out of this and I'll do that. You do this and then I'll do that. You know, deal. Like the guy said, I keep praying and praying and I never get any answers. And I said, oh yes, you do. Only 98% of the time the answer is no. Because we're almost always praying for something we want rather than what we need. You see, we'll get everything we need, but we may never get what we want. You see, there's four answers to prayer. There's yes and no and wait a while and how dare you ask. And I wasn't getting any place with these deals. And I figured there must be some better method of praying than that. So I said, Lord, thanks, amen. That's all. Lord, thanks, amen. Didn't enumerate anything. And do you know, from that day to this, the more I am grateful for, the more I get. And I don't even ask for it. A fellow sitting next to me says, but I don't have anything to be grateful for. And I looked at him and I almost agreed with him. He was a mess. And I said, well, fella, you can start by being grateful that wrinkles aren't painful. little things, little man. Or when you comb your hair in the morning, the hair you found on your comb didn't have a nerve root in it like a tooth. How would you like to comb your teeth every morning? And pull them out by the root, you see. Little things, little man. And the more I'm grateful for, the more I get. By coincidence, I was sitting in my living room and there was a rap on my front door. There was a man standing there I had never seen before in my life. And he said, "I am the minister of a church." He said, "I just happened to be in your neighborhood, and I would like to know if you and your family would like to join our church." Now, this man just happened to be in my neighborhood. And he just happened, by coincidence, to rap on the only door containing a drinking agnostic alcoholic for the next 6 blocks that I know of. He just happened to be in my neighborhood, and his church is 7 miles from my house. And I said to him, "No, I don't think so." Now, that was as mild an answer to that question as I had given in years. Because of my agnosticism, I had gotten in many arguments with men of the cloth, and invariably I would say something that they took as a blasphemous statement against whatever they believed, and that was the end of that. But I said, "I'd like to come down and talk to you about it." And I don't even know why I said that. But anyway, the next Tuesday, I surprised the both of us. I surprised him that I went, and I surprised myself that I went. But when I walked in his study, he was different, by coincidence. Because I hadn't said anything yet, and he said, "I don't care what you think. But if you don't tell me what you think, I can't help you at all." So with no holes barred, he and I took off on religion, and I met with that man for 14 consecutive Tuesdays, just like a two-man AA meeting. Only he had me reading the other big book. And I read that other big book from cover to cover, including the footnotes. Didn't miss a thing. Now remember, I'm three-quarters drunk most of the time, still fighting my alcohol. You ever try all them begats when you're half-lit? That'll drive you right up the wall. But out of this reading and out of these meetings, you see, I was able to develop for myself a creed that I can believe in. And I know that to this day it isn't what that man believed, and it doesn't make any difference. It may not be what anybody in this room believes, and it doesn't make any difference, so long as I believe in something bigger than I am. I also had to learn to go to meetings. People on the outside don't understand that. Why do you have to go to such cotton-picking many meetings? You ought to be up to here with meetings. Well, the simplest answer I know is that I never saw anybody get drunk at an AA meeting. And I never saw anybody sober up in a saloon. It's that simple, but they don't understand that. The Chinese proverb says, if you give a man a fish, he can eat for today. If you teach the man how to fish, he can eat every day of his life. You can't do that in one day. But probably Billy Graham had the best answer I know. He was over in Australia with one of his crusades, and he was coming back to the United States, and the fellow that brought him over there was simply astounded at these thousands of people that would pour out of the stadium each night. And he said, "Billy, you're going to go back to the States." He says, "Do you think this will have a lasting effect on all these people?" And Billy says, "How long does one bath last you?" You see, that's what these meetings are. They're baths. Remember, I said we're accident prone. We run into living and we pick up dirt, and we're entitled to get it washed off, and that's what the meetings do. I've never gone away from a meeting feeling as bad as I did when I went there. Never. Somebody wants to know where you're going, tell them you're going to take a bath. And then ask them, how often do you take a bath? That's a fair question. They ask you first. You see? Or you'd be like the deaf man in church. This deaf man, deaf as a post, couldn't hear sound one. Sat in the front pew every Sunday. Drove the minister crazy because he knew he couldn't hear. Couldn't even probably feel the vibrations from the organ, yet the man sat there every day, every Sunday. And finally the minister couldn't stand it anymore. He says, "Why in the world, because you're so deaf, do you come when you can't get anything out of this?" He says, "Because when they choose up sides, I want them to know whose side I'm on." And that's what these meetings do. I needed to strike something called balance in my life. You know, once you get a hold of this AA program, it's like a horse with a bit in his mouth, and he just takes off and runs with it, you know. And man, I'm doing all this stuff, and I'm going to meetings, and I'm reading AA literature, and I'm beginning to spout these sayings and all this stuff, and I think I'm doing great. And I drive my car in a driveway one day, and my son comes up and says, "Where you been?" As if it was any of his cotton-picking business where I had been. But I said, "Hold it a minute. Here I'm doing all these things, and I haven't established any faith in that kid at all that his dad can leave the house and come back sober. And I said, by George, I got some homework to do." You see, it's like a cross standing up here with three arms to it. And in order for this cross to stand here, it has to stand in something solid enough to hold it up. And we'll call that faith. And we'll label these arms home and AA and business. Now, I created all kinds of havoc where I lived, you see, and I was obligated to repair as much of that damage as I could. I created all kinds of havoc where I worked, and I was obligated to repair as much of that damage as I could. But I had to keep it in some kind of balance between the three, or if I let one of these arms get too long, the whole shooting match is going to tip over. The clock of life is wound but once, and no man has the power to tell just when the clock will stop at late or early hour. To lose one's wealth is sad indeed, but to lose one's health is more. But to lose one's soul is such a loss that no man can restore. The present only is our own, and you live, love, toil with the will. And you place no faith in tomorrow, for the clock may then be still. How much time do I have left to do what I ought to do? This is a question I ask myself after one of these sloshing around type meetings. You know, go to meetings and drink on the way home, and go to meetings and prove that they're wrong, and so on. I came out of the bank building one night and looked at all these stars up there, and I couldn't find an answer to that question. So on the way home, I took the half pint that was in the glove compartment and I threw it out the window, and I said, "I'm not going to drink anymore." And Lord, I had done that 100 times before then, as you well know. You know, half full, three quarters full, throw them out the window, I give it up. But I always watched where they landed, you see. Made a good supply in the state of Indiana where things are closed on Sunday. But this time I didn't watch where it landed. I hadn't even cracked a seal on this half pint yet. And to this day I wonder what poor soul picked it up, wondering what idiot threw it away without breaking the seal. Well, it gets to the basis of this whole business, and this is an action program, you see. I got to put this thing into motion. Nobody gets this program sitting where you're sitting. I never saw a game won by people sitting on a bench. They're won by people knocking their heads together out there in the middle of the field. There are no escalators to sobriety. You see, you plod this dude one step at a time. Did you ever stop to think that the footprints in the sand of time are made by work shoes and not bedroom slippers? The Spanish proverb says, "You can have anything you want," says God. Anything at all. Just take it. Take it and pay for it. And it's true. You decided that you wanted to drink, and you did, and then you pay for it. You decide that you want to stay sober, and you do, and it'll cost you something. And you have to be willing to pay one price or the other. But you can have either one. Like the man said, you've got the God-given right not to drink if you don't want to drink. But in spite of all the best AA in the world, you can read the literature till you get trifocals. You can go to meetings till they stick out of your ears. You can pronounce how it works verbatim from memory. And in spite of all this, there are days when, by God, all you can do is hang on. And it has nothing to do with the program, you see. The program didn't fail. Our humanness fails. And that's not reason enough for me to drink. I was going down the road, you know, he's going to join us. Yeah. When you get what you want in your struggle for wealth and the world makes you king for a day, then go to the mirror and look at yourself and see what the glass has to say. You can get what you want through the pathway of years and get pats on the back as you pass, but your final reward will be heartaches and tears if you've cheated the man in the glass. And why do we cheat ourselves is beyond me, you see. I can have anything I want. All I have to do is pay for it. If I did something good, I would shout from the rooftops and I wanted somebody to clap their hands and give me a ticker tape parade and so on, and I got it. The same fellow that if I did something that wasn't good, you wouldn't hear me shouting that from the rooftop. You kick it under the rug, you throw it in a closet and slam the door, and lo and behold, I was down the road and I had every reward I had coming. And I had a whole closet full of liabilities that I still had to pay for. And one day, in a saner moment, I says to myself, you dumb Flanagan, you're living backwards. If you do something that's good, keep it to yourself. You don't tell no but. If you do something that isn't good, pay for it today. And lo and behold, I was going down the road and all my debts got paid one day at a time. And I still got a market basket full of stuff to collect on, you see. But I'll get it, because the proverb is true. John Wesley says, you do all the good you can at all the times you can, in all the ways you can, to all the people you can, for as long as ever you can. If that don't keep you out of trouble, I don't know what will. You have to take time to laugh. It's the music of the soul. You have to take time to think. It's the source of power. You have to take time to play. It's the source of perpetual youth. You have to take time to read. It's the fountain of wisdom. You have to take time to pray. It's the greatest power on earth. You have to take time to love and to be loved. It's a God-given privilege. You have to take time to be friendly. It's too short a day to be selfish, you see. You have to take time to work, because work is the price of success. Now, in a little while, we're going to recite the Lord's Prayer. And after going through all that stuff that I went through, I have trouble with the Lord's Prayer at times. In fact, my wife quit going to meetings with me because I wouldn't say the Lord's Prayer at the beginning. She said, I won't even associate with anybody that won't say the Lord's Prayer. But I couldn't be a hypocrite about it. I didn't believe in it and I didn't say it. And after these 14 meetings and this credo that I was willing or able to develop for myself, I kind of took it to heart. And you have to say it with more than just mouthing it, you see, for it to mean anything, if I'm going to be grateful for what I have. I cannot say our if I live only for myself. I cannot say Father if I do not endeavor each day to act like His child. I cannot say who art in heaven if I am laying up no treasure there. And I cannot say hallowed be thy name if I am not striving for holiness. I cannot say, thy kingdom come, if I am not doing all in my power to make that day happen. I cannot say, thy will be done, if I am disobedient to his word. I cannot say, in earth as it is in heaven, if I will not serve him here and now. I cannot say, give us our daily bread, if I am dishonest. I cannot say, forgive us our debts, if I harbor a grudge against anyone else. I cannot say, deliver us from evil, if I do not put on the whole armor of God. I cannot say, thine is the kingdom, if I do not give to the king the loyalty that's due him. I cannot say, attribute to him the power, if I am afraid of what men can do to me. And I cannot ascribe to him the glory, if I am seeking honor only for myself. And I cannot say, forever, if the horizon of my life is bounded by time. Because the Lord is my sponsor and I shall not want. He maketh me to go to many meetings. He leadeth me and sit back and relax and listen with an open mind. And he restoreth my sanity and my health. He leadeth me in the paths of sobriety and fellowship for mine own sake. He teacheth me to think and to take it easy and to live and let live and to do first things first. He maketh me desire to be honest and humble and grateful. He teacheth me to accept the things I cannot change, change the things I can, and giveth me the wisdom to know one from the other. Yea, though I walk through the valley of despair and frustration and guilt and remorse, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me, the AA program, the new way of life, the 12 steps. They comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies, rationalization, fear, anxiety, self-pity, and resentment. Thou anointest my confused mind and jangled nerves with knowledge and understanding and love and hope. No longer am I alone, and neither am I afraid, sick, helpless, or hopeless. Surely sobriety, sanity, and serenity shall follow me every day of my life, 24 hours at a time. I told you at the beginning that I had been the receiver of more than one miracle. The miracle of sobriety should be enough for almost any one human being. But during the course of my sobriety, certain things begin to happen. You see, at the beginning, we are besieged with what I like to call soul-wrenching pain. I don't know of anything medically that treats soul-wrenching pain. You can go to any drugstore and there isn't anything on any shelf that treats this kind of pain. The first type of soul-wrenching pain that we get is remorse. There is no medication that'll treat remorse. And I sat in my living room with the tears running down my face, and no way could I relieve this pain except to pray. It was the only thing I had left. And I used to think that praying in the morning and praying at night was enough. And then I remembered from the Golden Books that sometimes you go hour in, hour out, minute in, minute out, if that's what it takes. And in St. Paul's letter it says you pray without ceasing if that's what it takes. And that's what I did. And I was sitting in my living room and like a bucket of water just coming over me, and the pain from the remorse disappeared. It didn't do what I had to do, but it got rid of the pain. Not too far down the road in my sobriety, they diagnosed one of my sons with a near-fatal disease. And we went through all kinds of things with that boy. And that'll give you gut-wrenching pain that no medicine will get rid of. And all I could do was pray, day in and day out. And one day I was in the doctor's lounge, and the doctor said, "How's your son?" I said, "He's going to be just fine." Because at that moment, a bucket of water, just like a bucket of water, came down, and this pain disappeared. Didn't solve the boy's problem, but it got rid of the pain so that you can think and act like a human being. Not too long ago, I was besieged by another episode of gut-wrenching pain. And all I could do from before, I said, it worked before, pray. And the more I prayed, the harder the pain got. And I prayed some more. And one day I was on the phone talking to a man in Oklahoma who I didn't even know. And all of a sudden, the envelope came down over my head and the pain went away. All I need to do to get rid of soul-wrenching pain is to pray. When Vincent Peale told me there was a power loose in this universe capable of solving anything, he was right. You don't have to believe that. I don't know any other reason why I would be standing here if it weren't so. I don't know when we will come across each other's paths again. This program is very weird. I had no idea they were even going to ask me back this time, you see. And I have other people in the audience who I've met other places. And you never know when we'll pass each other again. So till your path and my path crosses again someplace, may you have enough happiness to keep you sweet. May you have enough trial to make you strong. May you have enough sorrow to keep you human. May you have enough hope to keep you happy. May you have enough failure to keep you humble. May you have enough success to keep you eager. May you have enough friends to give you comfort. May you have enough enthusiasm to look forward. May you have enough faith to banish depression. May you have enough determination to make each day better than yesterday. And may the good Lord go with each and every one of you. Thank you very much.